This is a CBC podcast. CBC Books is the home for Canadian book lovers. Enter contests, watch videos, and listen to CBC Radio 1's Writers and Company and The Next Chapter all in one place. CBC Books, where readers click. Go to cbc.ca/books.
Du Théâtre Maisonneuve de la Place des Arts à Montréal, voici le Café Vinyle avec Stuart McLean.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Merci. The great British science fiction writer H.G. Wells, who wrote The Time Machine and The First Men on the Moon and The War of the Worlds, and spent virtually his entire life peering into the future, and when he wasn't doing that, dreaming about perfect worlds, wrote that every time he saw an adult on a bicycle, he no longer despaired of the human race. Well, H.G. Wells would be happy to find himself in Montreal this spring. Because seemingly overnight, for those of us not paying attention anyway, seemingly overnight, like one of those spring flowers nudging its yellow head through a snowbank, Montreal has become the greatest bicycle city in North America. Okay, I know that's a big statement, and I have no scientific proof. These things are a matter of opinion. But that's my opinion, and I'm prepared to take it a step further. I'm prepared to say that Montreal can suddenly be ranked among the great bike cities of the world. Don't have to take my word. Last year, Time magazine rated urban bike rides, and they ranked the 24-kilometer loop along the Lachine Canal and Rapids as the third greatest urban cycle in the world. Montreal's gone bike crazy. Probably the biggest thing that happened in Montreal last year was the arrival of the Bixi bikes. These are the community-owned bicycles that anyone can rent 24 hours a day. The bikes are locked, unsupervised at corners around the city, total of 5,000 bikes spread around 400 locations. An annual Bixi membership costs about $70. And with the membership, you have unlimited right to the use of the bikes, anytime you want. Here's how it works. You simply walk up to one of the bike racks, and they are everywhere you look. You swipe your pass, and you pull out a bike, and there is no charge for the first 30 minutes. You can ride anywhere in this city, and you don't have to bring the bike back to where you got it. You can leave it at any of the 400 racks around town. So you take the bike, you drive to lunch, you lock it up, and when you've finished eating, take another bike and drive it home. If you're a tourist, and tourists love the bikes, it costs you $5 for a 24-hour membership. The Bixi system was designed, built, and developed here in Quebec. They took money from the city's parking revenues and from the major sponsor, the aluminum producer, Rio Tinto Alcan. And it is so successful, they've already sold the technology and the concept to Minneapolis, Melbourne, and London, England. And there are at least another 10 cities around the world who are showing interest. It's a staggering success story. But it's not only the Bixi bikes that have made Montreal so cycle-friendly. There are also the bike lanes and bike paths. There are 500 kilometers of bike paths and lanes in the city of Montreal, 700 kilometers on Montreal Island. The most impressive of them, I would put forward, is the Claire Morissette bike path. Morissette was a passionate bicycle activist who, along with bicycle Bob Silverman, founded Le Monde à Bicyclette. And she fought with Montreal City Hall for 30 years about bicycles. She was once arrested, it's worth pointing out, for painting her own bike lanes on city streets. Well, times change, and sometimes profits get their due. The idea to name the bike lane in Claire's honor was endorsed unanimously by Montreal City Council, and she died just before it opened. She would have loved it. It's the only bike path in North America that I know of that goes right through the heart of a major city. That's the point of what's happening here in Montreal. They aren't just building bike paths where it's easy to build them. Claire Morissette's bike path runs along De Maisonneuve Avenue, which is a major Montreal street. It runs from one side of the city right to the other, an entire lane reserved for bikes and set apart from the cars by concrete barriers. In the mornings and the afternoons, you can see 10, 20, 25 people on bikes waiting at a stoplight. Some corners that can get so crowded, you see bike jams. So many bikes that everyone doesn't make it through a light. Seems everyone's on a bike in Montreal these days. People who used to hate bikes are on bikes. It is intergenerational and intercultural and interclass. There's no sense that the people in the cars represent the ruling class that's being confronted by rebels on bicycles. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that everything's perfect here. If it's perfection you want, you can go to Holland, where bikes coast up to intersections as if they were choreographed by a Tai Chi master. In Montreal, people scream up to intersections as if they're auditioning for the Cirque du Soleil. And they're driving on sidewalks and going the wrong way up one-way streets. You watch in horrified wonder until you finally spot a guy biking towards you in a helmet. And you think, okay, there's one sensible rider in the lot of them. And then he rides his helmeted head right through a red light. And as he passes you, you notice he has a cigarette in his mouth. Listen, I know there are problems. I know this isn't some perfect bicycle world that H.G. Wells has imagined into existence. I know to belong to the Bixie program, you need a credit card, and that excludes a certain part of the population. And I know the bike paths drive you crazy in the winter when snow clearing becomes an issue. And if you happen to be driving your car along to Maisonneuve and you want to turn left, you can wait forever to find a clearing in the stream of cyclists. I know you sit in your cars fuming, but the next time you find yourself sitting there thinking bad thoughts about bikes, and now, probably me. Remember this. You are a citizen of the best bike city on the continent. And know this too, when we come here from Toronto and Vancouver and even Ottawa, and we look around and see what you're doing, we find ourselves in danger of committing the mortal sin of envy. And if your contribution is just to sit in your car and smolder, well, that's a contribution. Am I guilty of hyperbole? I don't think so. Haven't been able to verify this, but I have been told, and I've been told this by more than one person, that the sale of bikes in Quebec makes up 40% of the bikes that are sold across Canada. Things are spinning in a wonderful way here in Montreal. The rest of the country would do well to pay attention. Well, it's my great pleasure now to introduce today's music guest, and I would be hard-pressed to describe his music to you. It's challenging. He expects a lot of his listeners. It's part melodic, it's part modern jazz, part Quebec rock. I hear echoes of harmonium in the sweep of it. It's a little bit symphonic, a little bit Cirque du Soleil, and it's totally off the wall. I love it. He had the honor, the great honor, of winning Canada's prestigious Polaris Music Prize for his album Close to Paradise. Ladies and gentlemen, from right here in Montreal, Patrick Watson and the Wooden Arms.
Thank you very much. Merci. There was a house everywhere in the world. I was invited in for a small taste of gin. There was a hall a thousand birds long, but the biggest one of all was in a cage too small. I asked the caretaker, cause he was a maker. Looked at me and laughed, took another sip from his glass and said, open up your ears and arms. You put a big bird in a small cage and I'll sing you a song.
Patrick Watson. That was Big Bird in a Small Cage. Patrick will be back, but I'm back now, and it's a good thing I am because it's time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Yeah. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, and they have to be short stories, and after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us, and we'll read some of our favorites here on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we'll send you a copy of the most recent Final Cafe book. Today's story comes to us from A.J. Mittendorf of Prince George, British Columbia. Dear Stuart, writes A.J., one spring day a few years ago, my wife and I went for a drive together. The wind was blustery, but we didn't care about the wind. We wanted to see the town. We wanted to say hello to it after a long winter. We wanted to smell the air and feel the wind. So we rode with all the windows open and with no radio and very little conversation. Our conversation was the pleasure of each other's company. The drawback to that day was the layer of winter sand covering the roads. It was dry, and the wind was blowing it in swirling dust devils. As we turned the corner onto one of the side streets near the college, we noticed two college-age girls walking together along the road. They were also enjoying the day. They were wearing light spring dresses, talking and laughing together. That was the fateful moment when two things happened at precisely the same time. The first was that a particularly strong blast of wind caught the hems of their dresses, so they both had to do a quick Marilyn Monroe dance. I turned my head and thought, if that wind had been moving a little faster, it would have blown those dresses clean over their heads. At that same moment, a gust of wind, doubtless the same mischievous gust that had ruffled the girls' dresses, blew dust into the car through my wife's window and right into my eyes. Another thought entered my brain. Now would be a good time for my wife to roll up her window. Those two thoughts collided in my brain, and rubbing my eyes, I turned to my wife and I said, "Honey, would you please roll up your dress?" She wasn't even wearing a dress, Stuart. But she just smiled and broke out laughing, and I pulled the car over and we laughed together. And that there, Mr. McLean, is a fine example of a woman with a sense of humor. Story comes to us today from A.J. Mittendorf of Prince George, British Columbia. Patrick Watson.
Sit down beside me and stay a while. Do a shot of the lights, do an old grain, till we got nothing left to say. That's what we want. That's what we need. That's what we want. sit down beside me and stay a while. Turn our arms away till the morning rises and we part our ways to our very last day.
Patrick Watson. Began on one of those glorious spring days, a day full of sun and hope, one of those days that arrives with promises of resurrection and rebirth, of redemption and, well, if we're going to keep the R's rolling, relief, said Dave. Feeling of relief, we made it through another winter. Dave was standing on his neighbor's porch, his dog Arthur sniffing at something at his feet, and Bert Turlington standing beside him, zipping up his blue windbreaker. Ever since the Turlingtons got their dog, a teacup Pomeranian named Tissue, Mary's idea, not Bert's, it's been Bert's habit to join Dave and his dog Arthur on their nightly walk. They walk up to the park, and when the weather's agreeable, they circle it endlessly, around and around like a sentence with no period, talking or not talking, allowing the dogs to insert the punctuation, which instead of commas and hyphens comes as fence posts and fire hydrants. Or as was the case on this evening, a shrub, which Dave's dog Arthur was sniffing with great intensity. Suddenly Arthur stopped and looked up at Bert and barked, more a grunt than a bark really, a soft grunt that came from deep in his throat. Bert squinted at Arthur. Bert said, "You sure?" And Arthur's tail started to wag and Bert shrugged, said, "Okay." And he unzipped his jacket and reached in and pulled out a little ball of fluff. Bert was carrying Tissue in a snuggly. Tissue tires easily. Bert set Tissue down and she shook herself, yapped, ran over to Arthur, sniffed the shrub, walked in a circle three times and prepared herself for business. When she was done, Bert bent over, scooped her up and gave Arthur a pat. "How does he know that?" said Bert. "Every night he picks her spot." It was on their way home that Dave offered to take care of Tissue during spring break. Bert and Mary were taking the twins to Costa Rica. Well, actually, they were taking the whole family. Last year, they left Adam home alone. That was a mistake. Although Adam got the house more or less back together for their return, there were things he had to leave until his parents got home. The broken hall banister, for one. And there were things he overlooked. Most unfortunately, a frat house tower of empties in the garage. Mary wasn't prepared to come home to a house in that kind of condition again. Mary wasn't prepared to let Adam stay home alone. Adam was coming with them, no arguments, and Tissue was going to get a dog sitter. "We can look after Tissue," said Dave. "Honestly, it wouldn't be a problem. No big deal." And so it was agreed. And once it was, how could Dave say no? And word got around, as word always does. And Carl Lobier called and asked about Preston. "I heard you were looking after Tissue," said Carl. "We just hate the idea of a kennel, and we were wondering..." "No problem," said Dave. Preston, a labradoodle, would be more of a handful than Tissue, no doubt about that, but Tissue is so small and eager that, well, like Dave said, she hardly counted. "Well, that's what I thought," said Carl. By the time spring break arrived and Dave counted up, he'd agreed to look after four dogs. So when Polly Anderson called, really, what difference did a fifth make? "Five dogs," said Morley. Well, six if you count Arthur, said Dave, but you can't count Arthur. He lives here anyway, and Tissue hardly counts either, so four dogs, technically. Living here, said Morley. Well, only for a week, said Dave. A week, said Morley. Well, said Dave, 10 days, technically. But that's if you count weekends. Six dogs. Number one being Arthur, Dave's dog, a mutt of sorts, a sort of lavish retriever, long hair, short hair combo. Kind of a biggish dog in a smallish way. Sleeps on the heat vents, likes ice cream. Two, Tissue, the Turlington's Pomeranian. Bert had been agitating for a dog for years. Bert had been thinking, chocolate lab. Tissue is no lab. In fact, she's not much bigger than a squirrel. Tissue is a purebred princess, pink leather collar, the snuggly. The day they left for the South, Mary brought her over with a crate load of stuff, blankets, bowls, stuffed toys, and a little collection of outfits, including a little bathing suit. Two-piece. She pulled a jar of hand cream out of her purse. It's made from caviar, said Mary. It keeps her paws soft. Massage some in before bed, after you shampoo her, when you do her nails, and if you're leaving her alone for more than 15 minutes. Then she handed Dave a toothbrush and a tube of toothpaste, beef flavored. Mary said, here are some Q-tips for her ears. She's allergic to dust. Keep her out of the basement. Dave sitting there nodding earnestly. She'll be fine, he said. Mary sensed Dave wanted her to leave. He was standing up. He was walking her toward the door. And she was absolutely right. He did want her gone. He wanted to be alone so he could try the beef-flavored toothpaste. Mary was almost out the door when she stopped and turned. I almost forgot, she said, I got you something. And she held out a life-sized silhouette of a bird, a hawk. You can put it in the back window, she said. It'll keep birds from flying into the window by accident. We were having trouble in the living room. I put one up there. It seems to be working. And then she was gone. Come on, Tissue, said Dave. Let's go brush our teeth. Arthur paddled along behind him. Arthur seemed pleased to have Tissue there. It was like a grade 5 sleepover or something. So that's how it started, with Arthur 1 and 2, Tissue. 3 was Summer. Portuguese water dog, afraid of water. Summer came with a little rubber coat and booties, a garbage hound. She'll eat anything, said Brian when he dropped Summer off. 3, Summer, 4, Preston, a labradoodle, bird crazy. Although what exactly Preston loved about birds, Carl didn't make clear, interested in birds. Just be careful around birds, said Carl ominously. 3 was Summer, 4 Preston, 5 Nunu, Polly Anderson's Cocker Spaniel, who pees when she gets excited. But all Cockers do that, said Polly. And what would she possibly get excited about, said Morley. Exactly, said Dave. How many's that? That's 5, said Morley. There's another, said Dave. The one with the leather chews. Leather, said Morley. Rawhide, said Dave. Rawhide chews, said Morley, sounding relieved. No. Rawhide's his name, said Dave. The chews are leather. I never even heard of Rawhide, said Morley. They're new people, said Dave. I've never met them, said Morley. And we have their dog? Just for a week, said Dave. Well, okay, 10 days. The dog started to arrive early on Sunday afternoon. At first, Arthur seemed excited as they got there. But as the afternoon wore on, he became increasingly anxious. His tail stopped wagging each time the doorbell rang. By supper time, Arthur would hold himself up at the downstairs bathroom and wouldn't come out. It's understandable. You put 6 dogs who don't know each other in a house together, any 6 dogs, any house, and there are going to be moments. And there were, no doubt about it. The first walk, just getting out the door was fearsome. Dave picked up a leash, one of the 6 leashes in the basket by the door, and Preston, who was sound asleep on the living room couch, lifted his head. And both his ears flicked up, but he didn't budge. He was waiting for one more jingle, and there it was. And with a second confirming jingle, Preston went from sound asleep to full speed running and barking. It happened in the blink of an eye. Preston was asleep and then he wasn't. He was running to the door as if he'd been running for hours. Preston had one thing on his mind, birds. And he wanted to tell everybody, birds, bark Preston, birds, birds, birds. And he passed Summer on his way to the door, and Summer jumped up to garbage, bark Summer, garbage, 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 birds, garbage. The two of them barking right past Nunu, who's asleep in the corner. And Nunu joins in, although she has no idea why she's running. She has no idea what's going on. She's just running, and by the time she's made it to the hall, she's so excited she stopped twice to pee. In the blink of an eye, all five dogs were at the front door, and they're jumping and barking, and Dave is standing there in the middle of them. Arthur, however, was nowhere to be seen. Dave finally found Arthur holed up in the bathroom, had to drag him out, put his leash on him before he could deal with the others. That first walk was a disaster. Second one wasn't much better. Arthur managed to slip loose in the park. Settled down under a tree, Dave couldn't budge him. Had to come back and get him once he brought the other dogs home. On walk number three, Dave had hardly gone 5 minutes before he came pounding home again. Burst through the front door. "I've lost a dog," he said desperately. "I'm a dog short." Morley looked at him calmly. Morley said, "You mean Rawhide," who it turns out was happily tucked behind the couch, gnawing on his shoe. Not Dave's shoe. Rawhide's owners had left a carton of shoes when they dropped him off. "We get them at the Sally Ann," they said. "Goes through 3 or 4 pairs a week." No doubt about it, those first few days were difficult. But slowly, Dave began to find his way. Started wearing tissue in the snuggly all day long. It's easier this way," he explained one night at dinner. He went shopping, bought himself a mountaineering belt with hooks all the way around. Put the belt on, clipped each dog to a separate hook before a walk. "Look at me," said Dave, "I'm hands-free." Which you'd think might be a good idea. And it worked until he had to bend over and scoop up after one of his dogs. And as he leaned over and was off balance, a pigeon fluttered by. Preston spotted it, barked and lunged, and everyone else joined in for the fun. Preston in the lead, the other five dogs fighting for it. Dave bouncing along behind them like a sled. Took Morley 45 minutes and a pair of tweezers to pick the gravel out of his bum. Oh yeah, there were moments. But Dave wasn't about to give up. That night, he lined the dogs up in the hallway. He had them at the far end of the hall by the front door. He was standing by the kitchen. He was determined to get control. "Sit. Sit." 3 of them went down like good little soldiers. Summer, Nunu, and Rawhide. Arthur went down too, but he went down reluctantly, and he went down with a growl. But Preston didn't budge. "Sit." Preston just stood there staring at Dave. So Dave went down. Dave dropped down to his hands and knees, and he crawled the length of the hall until his face was right against Preston's snout. "Grr," said Dave. Preston looked horrified. Preston dropped like a rock. "I have to establish dominance," said Dave to Morley, who was watching from the stove. In a way that she never would have expected, Morley was enjoying this. Whole thing had given Dave a sense of responsibility, a sense of seriousness, a sense of direction, a focus that she'd never seen before. Her only real concern was Arthur, who had developed an uncharacteristic melancholy. Dave was standing at the far end of the kitchen now. The dogs lined up by the stove. "Stay, stay, stay. Okay, come." And this time they came, All of them, a grand scrabbling over the kitchen floor, a scrabbling and a sliding stop at his feet, their tails thumping like a little dog orchestra. Good dogs, said Dave, good dogs, slipping each one a treat. Good dogs, yap, said Tissue from the snuggly. You too, said Dave. He saw Morley watching. He looked at her and grinned smugly, said, they're pack animals, and I'm the pack leader. Morley found this a little bit, how can I say this? A little bit sexy. And Dave sensed that. And he walked over to her, and he looked her right in the eye, and he said, who's your alpha dog? So everything was surprisingly fine for a few days, when suddenly it wasn't. By the end of the week, it was pretty clear something was wrong with Tissue. Her eyes were red and runny, and so was her nose. She spent all Thursday on the couch, disinterested in anyone or anything. She's allergic to dust, said Dave. My house isn't clean enough for a dog, said Morley. It's Mary's dog, said Dave. I don't want Tissue sick when they come home. And that's when Dave decided the best thing he could do would be to take the dogs over to Mary's house and spend the last two nights over there. It's funny, that's exactly what Morley said. It was sort of fun. Dave got to do stuff over there he'd never get away with at home. On the first night, he grilled a huge steak on the Turlington's indoor barbecue, and they all sat in front of the television watching the Iron Chef. Dave and the six dogs, each with their own plate of steak. He got to use the beef-flavored toothpaste every day. It's delicious, he said to Kenny Wong the first day. It's like brushing your teeth with a hot dog. Best of all, Tissue recovered. So everything was ship-shaped for Bert and Mary's return. They were due home just before supper. Dave spent the afternoon tidying up. He did the dishes. There were dog prints on the kitchen floor. He found a mop and mopped the kitchen floor. He watered Mary's plants. Things were better than ship-shape. They were perfect. Dave glanced at his watch. His plan was to take everyone back to his place, but not Tissue. His plan was to leave Tissue there to welcome Bert and Mary, who were due home in about half an hour. He felt a flush of pride. He had done well. And then Summer knocked over a dining room chair. It fell into the dining room wall. It left a long scratch in the paint. And there was just no way he was going to leave that for Mary to find, not when he was so close to perfect. Went down to the basement and found a stack of paint cans down there. And in the middle of the stack, he found one that had been marked dining room wall. There was a shelf of brushes wrapped neatly in rags. He grabbed a brush and the can of paint, and he ran upstairs, pried the paint open with a kitchen knife, picked up the brush, and then he put it down. And he gathered the dogs, and he put the dogs on their leashes. Better safe than sorry, he said to Tissue, who was sitting there watching him. And he led the dogs into the living room, and he tied them to Mary's potted palm. Stay, 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 stay. And he set out a couple of sheets of newspaper on the floor and set the lid down on the newspaper. It was worth taking a little extra time. It was worth being careful. And he got the brush, and he touched up the wall, and the mark disappeared in no time flat. Excellent. Glanced at his watch and ran upstairs, found a hair dryer, and 10 minutes later the paint was dry. You could hardly tell, or he could hardly tell. He grinned at Tissue. Good dog, he said. He was looking for the lid. Good dog, he said again, but he said it absentmindedly. Where was the lid? Tissue barked and stood up. There was the lid. Tissue was sitting on the lid. Her entire back end was soaked in paint. Tissue, said Dave. And at the sound of her name, Tissue's tail began to wag. Flecks of paint were flying everywhere. Dave caught her as she was heading for the kitchen. He scooped her up and looked around. Mary's dining room looked like a painting by Jackson Pollock. How was he going to clean this up before Mary got home? He ran downstairs and grabbed a jug of turpentine. He came running up, he opened the turpentine, he emptied it into a saucepan, and he rushed around wiping the walls and the floor. He was running out of time. Looked out the window and spotted the Turlington's car coming down the street. He was so close. All that was left was the paint-soaked tissue. "Sorry," he said, and he picked tissue up and he dunked her bum into the liquid. The next bit was a bit of a blur. Put tissue down on the counter, said stay, and he ran into the living room, over to the living room windows, and he threw open the curtains. And that's when Preston looked up and spotted the silhouette of the hawk that Mary had stuck there. Outside. Outside, a tan and relaxed Mary Turlington stepped out of the car and smiled at her husband. "It's good to be home," said Mary. And that's when the living room window exploded, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dogs sailed through it one after another like a circus act, Nunu spraying everyone as she sailed by. Mary staggered back and brought her hand up to wipe her face. And as she did, the front door burst open and her little dog Tissue came running towards her. Tissue's rear end was on fire. That's all right, Dave was right behind her with a fire extinguisher. Two days later, nearly midnight, the neighborhood quiet, Dave and Morley in bed, everyone in bed, all the dogs safely home, the Turlington's house back together. Dave put his book down, turned to Morley, said, "Well, anyway, no harm done." Morley, who was still reading, didn't say anything. Dave said, "I mean, Tissue's fine. No one died." "No," said Morley, "no one died." And then she said, "What's that noise?" It was a faraway sort of noise, a moist sort of wet faraway noise. Dave propped himself up on his elbow and frowned. "Is it in the wall?" he said. "I don't know," said Morley. "Maybe the closet." Dave got out of bed and stood in the middle of the bedroom listening. He walked over to the closet. Well, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. They say a lot of things, and not all of the things they say are true. Dave opened his bedroom closet, and there was his old dog, Arthur. Arthur was lying in Dave's closet amidst a pile of sodden leather. Arthur looking for all the world like a gourmand in a fancy restaurant. Arthur looked up at Dave later. Whenever Dave told this story, he'd swear Arthur smiled and burped. "Gave me a kind of reproachful look," said Dave. "Kind of like he was saying, you owe me, buddy." And he was right. Gave Dave that look, and then he turned back to the shoe he was holding between his paws, pulling at the soft leather as the saliva ran down his jowls. Dave looked at Arthur and then over at Morley. "What is it?" she said. "Nothing," said Dave. "No harm done," said Dave. And he closed the cupboard door gently, and he got into bed, and he reached out and turned off the lamp on the bedside table. And he reached out for his wife, and he put his arms around her. "Good night," he said. "Sleep tight. I love you." Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank our special musical guests, Patrick Watson and the Wooden Arms. Thanks also this week to Brad Scrutton, Bill Herault, Guy Charbonneau, Pierre DeLong, and Mathieu Parisien for the technical assistance, and everyone else here at Place des Arts. David Amer is the founding producer of the show. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean, and we're going to let Patrick sing us out. So long for now.
Life sings a happy song. I put on my wolf suit up. We'll be right back.
you've been listening to The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. Over the next few months, Stuart McLean will be doing live Vinyl Cafe concerts in Burlington, Ontario, Almont, Ontario, Milton, Ontario, St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, and Danceland in Manitou Beach, Saskatchewan. You can check the website for all the details, vinylcafe.com.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.